This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you today. Alec Murtaugh. We're going to be talking more about that case and go into some of the evidence or lack thereof that one would expect to be in existence in a double homicide murder trial, and also talk about some body language and just the overall circus that is the Alec Murtaugh case with Scott Roeder, forensic reconstruction specialist and owner of Evidence Room, LLC. Scott, I want to ask you this. With everything that's been presented thus far, do you think there's been any evidence that proves Alex was the gunman?
Well, not yet. There seems to be, you know, all of the inferred evidence and all of the character evidence. I think when you go through a trial like this, the first strategy that the prosecutor is going to try to do is reveal the type of character that is on trial and the cast of characters around this Alex Murtaugh. And then they get into, the physical evidence of the murder and, you know, kind of putting it through a funnel of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And, the standard for conviction in court is not beyond all possibility. It's beyond a reasonable possibility. So that gives in the jury's mind, from the perspective of the defense lawyer, that sliver of sunshine to hope that they can compartmentalize their overall impression of the situation with just the admitted and direct evidence. That's a difficult line to walk as a defense attorney, but if that's all you have, that's what you're going with. And they're trying to whittle away little by little at the convincingness and reliability of each individual piece of evidence. But all evidence points toward being very incriminating. So I think that the prosecutors are doing a great job, and the defense attorneys are boldly defying it as best they can. And I think, based on what I'm reading out of this case, being bold is not just a strategy, it's a lifestyle.
What I'm surprised by is the lack of some evidence that one would assume would exist in some way, shape, or form. Did the police mess this up right away by almost assuming that Alec was not remotely a suspect? What I'm talking about is it's a double homicide that happened here. There, we haven't seen any sort of evidence of door handles, of the hose, other than it existing and being out of place. It doesn't seem like they did due diligence immediately after this crime to look for prints, to look for DNA on some things, to look for cleaning solutions, anything that would, if there's like a bleach everywhere or on something to clean something up, that would be kind of questionable. Why is there bleach on this door handle if that would have been there? And it's just very surprising to me that things that would pop up normally in a homicide investigation as evidence, whether it points to that person or not, has not shown up yet in this trial. Did they simply not do those things, I guess would be question number one. And if they did not, why? Because even if they're assuming that Alec is innocent at that moment in time with his clout and everything else, wouldn't they still want to get that to try and find whoever it truly was?
Well, to answer the first question, I think it's pretty clear that, and I'll address it in the second question of why, but I think it's pretty clear that critical transient evidence was not searched for, was not protected, collected, and analyzed. The fingerprints, the DNA, gunshot residue, cleaning solutions, and then doing those things. And there's a reason why they call it transient evidence, because it's movable and it's dissipatable. You know, unlike pollutions in the Ohio River by Norfolk Southern, the evidence that's transient in this case doesn't stick around for a long time. And that's why, as a crime scene tech, you want to be there within 24 hours of the incident, collecting and preserving all of this evidence. Now, they didn't do that, right? So the next part of your question is, why didn't they do it? Mm-hmm. And I think that question is a much more tricky question to answer, in that you have to kind of get into the hearts and minds. It could be three things, right? It could either be lack of ability and know-how and experience. Excuse me, but I doubt that, but it's possible. It could just be, being biased, or it could be, a combination of those things. When you have people like this that are really in charge of and have a heavy influence over the infrastructure of a law enforcement community, friends, relationships, favors, bias, turning the other cheek on other instances for a long period of time. You could say that the water is already poisoned before the dead body got thrown in it, just to throw another railroad analogy in there for you.
Because yes, railroads are a theme in the Murdaugh legacy. If you look back, it's just shocking to me about some of those things where there doesn't seem to be a logical explanation for some of those things.
I think there is a logical explanation, Tony. And if you and I are just going to talk as a couple of guys over a cup of coffee, I think that the reach of the Murdaugh family goes pretty far and wide. Mm-hmm. And they have the ability, maybe not through direct action, but through implied history of what they're capable of, to put pressure on people to either don't do their job or be quiet.
And that's something that I thought was interesting that would come up throughout some of the interrogations in the following days of the Murdaugh murders. There's been a new piece of video that was released, and we've already seen many instances in which Alec becomes very chummy and buddy-buddy with a lot of these guys. But there is two things I want to talk about. The first one being immediately the body cam footage when they showed up to the scene. And Alec is outside in his stark white T-shirt, almost smelling of downy freshness. And the first thing, within 60 seconds, he is already telling the police that have shown up the likely motive for the murders. It's not, I don't know what happened. Oh, my God, I'm in shock. You literally just saw your son's brain lying by his legs. And you are immediately ready to say, we've been getting threats about this boat accident. Long story short, it's not the moment in time necessarily to be giving what you think is the theory. Yes, everybody does react differently to trauma, but it almost seems like he's immediately trying to steer this in one direction.
I agree with you on that 100, as the kids say. The demeanor of an individual at the time of a big incident like this is very revealing, right? If you come across a dead spouse or family member, and that family member is not just devastated. You know, there's something to be said for people who can compartmentalize dramatic situations, but, you know, but when it's your own family, I don't see how you can be so composed unless you're deliberately trying to minimize yourself by not calling attention to yourself. But, you know, it's a sociopathic, narcissistic characteristic. And we're seeing that a lot lately. It seems like that's an epidemic of cases that we're discovering of, you know, people that are trying to plant, you know, some kind of a, an immediate alternative solution that points away from themselves. You know, as a law enforcement person, which I am not, but I can imagine if a law enforcement person, you know, individual, you know, you see somebody on the scene and they're immediately pointing at other people in a very calm way when they should be devastated. I mean, all kinds of alarm bells would go off, but it didn't go off in this case. And I think that goes back to your other question of why didn't it go off in this case? Why weren't they suspicious from the very minute they got there based on his behavior? You know, you said the white shirt and everything. You would think that, you know, you'd be holding your child and your wife, you know, and have blood on you as you're hugging them as they, I don't know anybody that wouldn't touch their deceased family member in that situation. I find it all very bizarre. And I feel like they live in a parallel reality, their family there, where these kinds of things are somewhat permissible and gotten away with historically. It's just confounding, that these situations pop up like this on a regular day by day basis, Tony. You know, it's kind of a strange time to be around.
Scott Roeder with Evidence Room LLC Forensic Reconstruction. Thank you so much for your insight onto this case. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our discussions, insight, and trial coverage as we bring it to you right here. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.